This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Now we get to get down to what I consider the fun stuff. All the rest of this has been introduction and window dressing, although very serious window dressing, because as you can tell, basically what I've done is I've discredited Michael Martin's approach to things, and you have to realize you're dealing with a man who will resort to this kind of move, to begging the question, not having a general theory to back up what he's claiming, and so forth. So, I mean, that takes a lot of the fang out of these arguments, it seems to me. So I don't want to just say it's merely introductory material, but I've got tougher stuff yet that I want to get into. Is there a hand?
Yeah, I just have one point. I guess it's kind of defends him in one respect that shows his presupposition in the other. In the first page of the book, Roman numeral 11,
yes,
he admits it is difficult to understand how something could be uncaught. And he's bringing out how Louis Young taught to him as a child that that was one of the problems of being an atheist. So for him to revert back to on-cause-effect is at least consistent with his presupposition.
Yes. Now, what you're pointing out is that, in a sense, he's willing to admit that's the nature of my worldview. But what I was saying, just so you don't lose the effect of this punch, what I was saying is, in so doing, he's departing from what is taken as an exemplar of rationality. You know, if you just want to look at the paradigms of being a rational person, you follow first-order predicate logic, you believe that explanations in terms of causes should be sought for events and things like that. And so, yeah, it's not that he's being inconsistent with what is ultimately the character of his worldview or even his upbringing with his step-grandfather, but it is a departure from a paradigm of rationality. And so if I were doing, and this is not what my debate's going to come down to, because in the first place, you know, he's not going to like all the stuff that I'm saying. And he's going to say, oh, not this, you know. It'd take a long time to finally track him down and say, look, it's in the book over and over again. This is what you've done so far. But if we got to that place, I think you could simply say, well, what you're saying then is, if you want to be an atheist, you have to be willing, at least at times, to depart from the paradigms of rationality. But I'm not willing to depart from the paradigms of rationality. And so now I'll let the audience choose. Do you want atheism with a little bit of irrationality, or would you like to keep your rationality and become Christians? I mean, if that's what it comes down to, I'd say that's doing a pretty good job. I'd be pretty happy as an apologist to leave it at that. Okay, now, the last major point that I put on the board yesterday about Martin's overall approach is that he doesn't even consider the strongest case against his conclusion or his presupposed atheism. And I'm going to point that out by looking at page 264. And then I'm going to follow it up by saying, nevertheless, without realizing what the nature of the challenge is, the transcendental character of the challenge, he does address certain illustrations or aspects of the presuppositional case, and we're going to go through the book and pick those up and see how well he does with them. But first of all, turn with me to page 264. I've telegraphed this to you yesterday, what's coming, but when I read this book, I'm wondering to myself, I wonder if you'll get around to dealing with what we might call a Van Tillian kind of argument. He may not have heard of Van Til. I mean, that's not the issue here. But does he even understand that that's one of the possibilities, especially in light of the fact that he tends to be so thorough? You know, he's even thorough on our side. He wants to go through all these different guys who try to argue with this argument and so forth. And then he argues with them, and he has all these variations of theism and agnosticism and so forth. I mean, the general approach is detailed, finely tuned, and so forth. And so I'm thinking, well, whether he's read Van Til or not, I wonder if he'll ever say, well, you know what they might say is, we really do believe in God, even though we say we don't. And then try to give some meaning to that and so forth and so on. It's not impossible. If a guy's just running through the possibilities, that he'd say that. And then I come across this page where the subheading, I'm going, he did think of that as a possibility. What's he going to do with this now? Okay, good. You know, now we get to meet the battle. Could an atheist have faith in God? It's to say, I maintain that atheists do have faith in God. That it's in light of that faith that we have rationality in the terms of science and logic and moral absolutes and so forth. And so I'm kind of expecting that. But you all know already, if you've read the book and from what I told you yesterday, when you read the section, to our disappointment, it has nothing to do with the Vantillian thesis or with the transcendental challenge. And I do hold that against him, not as a matter of, well, why isn't my favorite school considered? But I hold it against him as a failure in his scholarship and consideration. Because if there were a person who had a very, very arcane, strange minority view of how carburetors work, and I were writing a book on auto mechanics, and I didn't take that into account, I don't think anybody could fault me, you know. It's true that I didn't consider everything, and maybe I didn't even know there was a strange view out there. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not saying, you know, hidden away, you know, somewhere, there's this really, really strange, bizarre view that he forgot to take up. What I'm saying is this was right in front of his face. And I know it's right in front of his face because he uses the English words that express the thesis. Now, in other cases where he has an argument and a version of the argument doesn't work, he gives us the impression that he looks for other interpretations of the argument, right? Then that would get so frustrating. He's got, you know, on this definition, B. Well, then we try this definition, C. And then, I mean, he goes through these permutations of possible interpretations to see if it'll work. Why didn't he do that with the line, here's the thesis, atheists have faith in God? He could have said, well, now, but what if we took it in this way? What if we took it in that way? Even by accident, it seems to me, he'd have to come across what turns out to be a historical reformed approach to apologetics. But he didn't.
Could he maybe think he does that when he deals with Huntington's view of basic beliefs?
I do take that into account in when I say he does have elements of transcendental reasoning. It's not Flanagan. He does have elements of transcendental reasoning that he addresses, but he never addresses it as a transcendental claim. And maybe it's time to explain that. You know, it's one thing to say everything is caused, or everything's not caused, or, you know, so forth. It's another thing to say, as a transcendental for saying everything is caused, you must believe in God. A person can interpret causation in such a way, I'm gonna be kind of crude about this, intellectually crude about this, but you could say God is the first cause. He's the beginning of the chain. And so anybody who looks at causal arguments, you know, might end up talking about something that I want to talk about, causation, but he's not talking about it as a transcendental claim. Because my point is not that you can put God at the end of the cause, at the end of the chain of causes. My point is you can't talk about cause meaningfully without a worldview in which there is this kind of God. So transcendental challenges have to do with what comports with the things you are saying or your practices. Everybody in this world condemns certain things. It's impossible to live in this world and say, oh, I don't condemn anything. I said, do you condemn people who condemn others? Oh, yeah. You've got to condemn something. That's just one of the conditions of living, you know. Making choices is a form, attenuated, but a form of condemning the things you don't choose. So everyone engages in condemnation. However, no one can make sense of saying that our condemnations are moral rather than just conventional, convenient, something that suits our pleasures. No one can make sense of saying that those choices are moral apart from a Christian theistic worldview. That's a transcendental challenge. It's saying that you cannot account for the characteristic of moral judgments given any other worldview than Christianity. Okay. So yeah, he does consider Plantinga, but the way in which, well, Plantinga is not a transcendentalist, so you can fit this, but those elements of presuppositional function that you see in Plantinga or you see in Wittgenstein and Fideism, he never puts into a transcendental position. In fact, you'll notice he dismisses both Wittgenstein and Plantinga ultimately on the same grounds, that it reduces to relativism. Here's my comeback. I'm not a fideist, as he's interpreted, not a full-fledged Wittgensteinian, and I'm not a full follower of Plantinga. But you know, they could defend themselves. They could say, okay, our approach to religious epistemology or language reduces to relativism. And your worldview affirms relativism, so no problem. But you see, at that point, he's going to say, I'm no relativist. And that's when Dr. Van Til steps forward and says, now listen, Plantinga, sit down, because at this point we need to get beyond what you're doing and now talk about transcendentals. I realize he's going to claim he's not a relativist, but my challenge is you can't make sense of your objectivism. Given your worldview, you should be a relativist. And if you are a relativist or should be a relativist, you shouldn't complain when Plantinga and Wittgenstein turn out to be relativists. So you see, it's always a matter of taking what the unbeliever gives you and choking him with his own theory. Anyway, we don't see that kind of presentation. And that's another thing. It's not just that he considers the thesis that all men really do know God, even though they claim to be atheists, and then run with it. He never considers the possibility that atheism doesn't provide the preconditions of intelligibility for its own claims. He just thinks autonomous reason can get up and run on its own. I'm no Dojeverdian. I have a lot of problems with Dojever, to be honest with you. But one theme that runs through Dojever that I appreciate very much, over and over again, Dojever pierces the presumption of Western rationalism that its own starting points have been examined. Over and over again, he points out that the autonomous reason assumes that it can be autonomous. It doesn't prove its autonomy. It just takes it for granted. So that's another thing that we might have expected him to do. There's quite a tradition of attacking autonomy. You know, he knows of Plantinga. Why doesn't he know about Van Til, Dojeverd, or that general, you know, school of thought? Well, names aside, if he runs through all the permutations and the possibilities, why didn't he consider that possibility? Well, what does the Bible tell us? You know, the one thing he might come close to, but he's never going to step into, is just that. Because then, you see, he's hooked, isn't he? Because how's he ever going to escape from, you know, the possibility? He sees it as a possibility. We see it as the explanation. That all of this is just so much rationalization of prejudice. And especially, how's he going to escape that now that Dr. Bonson's taken a day and a half to introduce all of the rationalized prejudice that you see in this book? Well, anyway, he comes close to Van Til's thesis, but he doesn't really get around to considering it. Let's look at the thesis that he does consider here on pages 264 to 265. He says, would it be possible for X to have faith in God yet not believe that God exists? If so, could an atheist have faith in God? And then he refers to Posman's paper, where he argues that propositional belief is not necessary for religious faith, and that religious faith can be founded on hope. To explain very simply, Posman is saying that when I make a religious confession of faith, when I stand up and I say, I believe in God, or I believe in Jehovah, that basically what I'm doing is not giving a proposition, but rather I'm expressing an attitude of my heart. I hope that the universe is such that Jehovah exists. I'm going to live my life in light of that affirmation and that hope. He says, if Posman's thesis is correct, perhaps a person who does not believe in God, but who nevertheless hopes that God exists, could still have faith, quote unquote, in God's existence. That is, if somebody were to take the religious confessor and say, now, are you making a claim that God exists? He might say, I don't think I can do that. All I can tell you is I can express the attitude I have toward the universe. I hope God exists. I wouldn't assert that God does or make any effort to defend it.
Yeah, he's calling that religious faith, but isn't that actually agnosticism?
Well, it's agnosticism with a prejudice, let's say. Here's a person who says, I can't make any assertion. All he's getting at is, can't we use the word faith for profession of hope, what it amounts to. Because we may be guided by a weak probability or even the bare possibility that something is true. In such a case, we may be guided by hope and not belief. So in other words, the things that I will say or that I will affirm, my avowals may be pulled by an attitude of hope rather than by evidence. Hope entails desire for the state of affairs hoped for and a disposition to do what one can to bring about this state of affairs. Poseman says, faith in God can be what is termed experimental faith. We're now on page 265. Although faith in God does not entail the belief that God exists, it does entail belief in the possibility that God exists and commitment to living as if God exists. Poseman maintains that whether it is rational to have faith in God in this sense depends on the outcome of an analysis of comparative values in relationship to probable outcomes, what he calls a cost-benefit analysis. And then Michael Martin says, whether Poseman is correct depends on the status of the concept of God and of religious language. And then he pulls out his big guns, chapters 2 and 12. He points out in chapter 2, he thinks, that religious language is meaningless. And then in chapter 12, that the concept of God is incoherent. You have noticed, by the way, for all the chapters here, the three big, the heavyweight arguments for him are religious language is meaningless, the concept of God is incoherent, and the problem of evil. These three, over and over again. And so when I deal with those three, which is my game plan here, I'm hoping to take away any stick with which he might beat us, because none of those work. And right now I'm in the process of showing, and he doesn't even consider the best argument for Christian theism. In fact, he wastes a lot of our time. We may not even be able to get into much of it the way things are going. He wastes a lot of our time just, you know, trampling through all the versions of the cosmological, all the versions of the ontological, all the versions of the teleological argument, religious experience, cost-benefit analysis, and so forth. And if we have time, I want to look at that because you've read it and it's all very interesting. But the bottom line is, especially if you're out of time, but the bottom line is, those aren't our arguments anyway. So whatever you've done to hurt Swinburne or, you know, anybody else doesn't really bother me. I said Swinburne, pardon me. And right now the point I'm making is, and the best argument for God's existence, you didn't even bother to look at. When we get done, I will have shown, hopefully, that Michael Martin has engaged in a long version of circular reasoning, begging the question, just rationalizing his own prejudices, basically. Secondly, that the best argument for God's existence he doesn't even take up, and when he gets close to it, he doesn't effectively deal with it. And thirdly, his arguments against Christian theism are all ineffective. And my conclusion will then be that he failed in the task in this book. We're only at the point now, though, of his dismissing Poseman's thesis that faith could be hope or experimental faith that follows a cost-benefit analysis. He says, now, you can't get to a cost-benefit analysis unless you get past my argument about religious language and the incoherence, the concept of God. And then he also has a chapter on beneficial reasons by which he will say none of them really work. By the way, I'm not all that far from Michael Martin when he gets on to those sorts of things. He says a lot of things that are cheesy and I don't like and all that. But in the end, I don't think Pascal's approach works either. So it's kind of interesting. We could make common cause in arguing against some of these arguments. He says that you can't make Poseman's approach work. He says there is no acting as if one believes that God exists in general. There are many sets of behaviors that might be referred to as acting as if one believes in God. And then on the next page, 266, he says, another crucial question would remain, what would be the most rational choice among theistic religions, denominations, and sects? And I just put in my margin, maybe you've already figured this out, these are throwaway arguments. It doesn't make any difference. All Posham has to say is, okay, well, there are some people who act out a Baptistic approach. There are some people who act out in hope a Hindu approach. There are some people who act out a Roman Catholic approach. And so, in a sense, all our author is doing is he's saying to Poshman, if your approach to religious epistemology is acceptable, it still doesn't answer all the questions. Because we still have to ask whether it should be Romanist theism, or Baptist theism, or Hindu theism, or whatever it may be. See what I'm getting at?
Isn't his view a little bit like Poshman's only as an atheist? I mean, he doesn't decide which epistemological viewpoint he's going to stand on, since he's kind of,
Well, but you see, on Poshman's analysis, he's saying that when I say I have faith in God, I'm telling you I have hope that this will work out, and the reason I'm acting as if it's true is because of a cost-benefit analysis. Our author says cost-benefit analysis, one, doesn't support theism, and probably supports atheism. I don't think he would say that his profession of atheism is just a hope looking for a theory. He'd say it's more than hope. He says it's an epistemic claim. Do you remember how he uses that? At the end of the section, just below the middle of 266, he says, until this sort of question is answered, Poshman's talk of experimental faith is unwarranted. Well, here's my response. One, I don't hold to Poshman's view, so, you know, no big deal. But I do think it's illegitimate to say that Poshman's approach needs to answer all these questions, like what kind of theism it's going to be. I mean, Poshman could just get arbitrary and say, all I'm talking about is acting out Christian faith. You know, and then the comeback would be, okay, so even if you have a foundation for faith, Christian faith, you don't know that that's the only one. Poshman could say, I'm only talking about hope here, I'm not talking about epistemic claims like it's true. And when he says that he has to get this sort of question answered, I just want to know, that's overstated. Poshman doesn't have to answer all those questions in order to make sense of his view that professions of faith are professions of hope. Nevertheless, that's not my view. I want to know now, where's the rest of the section? Now, take the idea that an atheist has faith in God, not in the sense that a person who doesn't have epistemic reasons for God nevertheless hopes that there's a God. Take it in the strong sense, that a person who says there is no God nevertheless believes that there is a God. You know, let's try that interpretation. I'm just rehearsing what I've done already. Why doesn't he do this? That's the closest you're going to get in the entire book to dealing with what is Van Til's basic argument. He does consider, however, in passing, the thesis that there is an innate knowledge of God. And that's crucial to a presuppositional approach. I just want to make sure you realize that the claim of the innate knowledge of God is not the transcendental challenge. Because a person could theoretically be a fideist and hold to the innate knowledge of God. A person can say, everybody knows that God exists, but the Bible tells me that everyone knows that God exists, but there's no way rationally I can ever get to that. Everyone's going to live in their own little sealed-off, subjective container of life. And so I can't argue with it. All I can tell you is, based on what the Bible tells me, I think you believe in God anyway. But you see, that isn't Van Til. You might say, well, that's a starting point for Van Til's argument. It certainly is, but it's a starting point for many arguments, as long as you believe Romans 1. But it's another thing to go beyond that and say, and those who refuse to acknowledge that they have faith in God are made to be fools. That part of Romans 1 is an argument. It's saying, you can reduce to absurdity those who are suppressing the truth and unrighteousness to show that they must be believing in God to make sense of what they themselves are doing or their conception of rationality, science, or morality. So we're going to look at the claim and the alleged refutation that the knowledge of God is innate, but I want to make very clear that this comes nowhere close to considering the transcendental argument of the presuppositionalist. Although it's very important, what we're doing from this point on is all P.S. then. My argument, my criticism, is this. The best, the strongest form of theistic proof, he never gets around to or even considers, even when he's got language that seems to suggest that he knows or should know what it is. But now let's just look at bits and pieces. The innate knowledge of God, pages 211 and 212. This comes, you notice, interestingly, in the context of an alleged argument from common consent. This is a good way to illustrate my point, that he doesn't put the argument in the right framework. Because I'm nowhere close to endorsing an argument from common consent. I don't believe that. But I have to go to this silly argument from common consent to find anything in life I would consider my approach to apologetics, the transcendental presuppositional approach. He points out that there are three versions of the argument from common consent, the first of which is relevant to our purposes. The first version, bottom line of 210, belief in God is innate or instinctive. It is then maintained that the best way to account for this fact is to suppose that God made his creatures in such a way that they would not be deceived. Okay, I believe that the knowledge of God is innate. You can call it instinctive. I like the dispositional analysis even better. People are born in such a way that whenever they're able to develop self-conscious and rational, you know, considerations, they believe in God. They could affirm that. They have the ability and they have the disposition to affirm that. He says there's two basic problems with that. For one thing, there's no adequate evidence that the factual premise on which the argument rests is true. For another thing, if the factual premise is true, the existence of God is not thereby shown. But let me dismiss number two, first of all. Because I think he feels like he's making a really important claim, but he's not. Because basically he can say, all right, let's say we find out that everybody does innately believe in God. That doesn't mean God exists. There could be another explanation for why they innately believe in God. I have two things to say. One, in no other case of alleged innate knowledge do we dismiss it as it's not true. So you're showing a whole lot of prejudice here. In every other acknowledged case of innate knowledge, we say it's not just innate belief, it's innate knowledge. That is to say, it's a justified true belief, and it's justified by its innateness. And so he's really here introducing a distinction that's not true to the history of innate knowledge talk, or innate notions. And beyond that, if he wants to say all you've proven is everyone must believe in God, in light of the way I presented it in the transcendental framework, I'm willing to say that's fine. If it turns out that the only way you can be rational is by believing in God, and that doesn't prove to you that God exists rationally, I don't know what will count as an argument. See, what I'm getting at is, in that sense, if he's reduced my argument to, okay, everybody believes in God, and that's what's necessary for rationality, but then maybe the world's not rational, I say, okay, so we're down to, it's irrationality in atheism or rationality in Christianity. And we've been past this barn before, right? I'm willing to accept that. I think that's a pretty good position to be in, apologetically. Say, the only way you can save your rationality is to come to Christ. Those who don't come to Christ are fools. That sounds biblical, doesn't it? So that second consideration is really a throwaway. It doesn't hurt at all. The first one is there's no adequate evidence that the factual premise on which the argument rests is true. The next line, or the first line of the next paragraph says, there is, quote, no good reason to suppose that belief in God is innate. Universal negative, right? There's no good reason. Well, maybe he hasn't considered all the reasons. But it's worse than that. It's not just the general throwaway criticism that I'm giving you here. Because it turns out that in order to prove the innateness of this knowledge of God, he considers basically surveys of what people will say. Well, as it turns out, if that's the line of evidence that he's considering, it's not even relevant to my thesis. Because my thesis is that people will pervasively not say they believe in this God. Okay, so all I'm getting at here is he's not even considered that opponent out there. He's just taking this simplistic idea that everyone will say they believe in God. He goes, lo and behold, no good reason to think that, because when you do the surveys, not everybody says they believe in God. Now just do me the favor, of trying complications on the theory that you're testing, similar to all the other ones that you do in hundreds of pages, Thucker. How about this possibility? Everyone innately believes in God, but there's some reason for a number of people, maybe many, most, or all, not being willing to admit it. Or in fact, maybe not even thinking they do believe in God. Why not the self-deception theory? I mean, I did my doctoral dissertation on it, now I am kind of put out. Why didn't you bother to consider, and this is in the literature, by the way, there's scads of articles and books on self-deception. Why didn't he say, well, here's another possibility. The knowledge of God is innate, but people are self-deceived, and so they don't confess it.
He did use the self-deception theory when he tried to say that that's why Christians are deceived. He didn't use the other edge of the sword.
Yeah, that's right. But he doesn't consider this theory of self-deception. But if he did, what good would it do to go out and do surveys and you have a lot of people tell you they don't believe in God? That, in fact, confirms my thesis, doesn't it? That's exactly what my thesis would tell you to expect. You go out there and do a survey, a lot of people say, no, I don't believe in Jehovah. So you get my point. He does consider the idea of innate knowledge of God, but he doesn't consider it in such a way that he really does any damage to presuppositional apologetics. Let me just finish the paragraph here. There's no good reason to suppose that belief in God is innate. In one sense of the term, a belief is innate if it's present to the mind at birth. In another sense, a belief is innate if there's a disposition to acquire it without instruction by simply being exposed to such facts as that there is sin. And then he footnotes, guess who he says believes that? Charles Hodge. Well, Charles Hodge didn't believe that. And then he says, certainly belief in God is not innate in the first sense, for there is no reason to think that small children believe in God. Well, yeah, there's no reason to think they do in the sense that they don't give any verbal evidence of believing in God. Moreover, the theory that belief in God is innate does not account for the presence of millions of atheists. Well, we just accounted for it. In fact, I'm going to take every one of those pieces of statistical information as confirmation of my theory. My theory is, given what Paul says in Romans 1, you should find millions of atheists in this world who nevertheless know God. And so he goes out and goes, you know what, I found out that there are millions of atheists in this world. I say, well, that's part of our thesis. He says the second interpretation has similar problems. There's little reason to suppose that children always acquire their belief in God. And then notice he says, without instruction or training. And I put in my margin here, that is not a necessary condition for believing the knowledge of God is innate. Without instruction or training. That is, you have to exclude religious training, and then you have somebody use the word God that they've never heard of, I guess, or something like it. And he says that would show that it's innate. But as long as they have religious instruction, you don't know whether it was innate or whether it was instilled in them by the instruction. Well, I don't believe that it comes down to only those two options. The third option that he does not consider is that a child will not confess belief in God without instruction, and that may basically just be instruction on how we use our language. And then I would say, as long as somebody knows how to use the language, they have a disposition, once they encounter the concept of God, to say, oh, that's true. But now he has to fall back on his first argument, doesn't he? He has to say, but they don't say that. And I say, I know, because there's more to the picture than that. When they have the evidence of God's existence, and of course it's always there, but I mean, imagine that you have a child who finally starts saying, oh, some people think there's a creator of heaven and earth. At that point, I maintain the evidence for the truth of that understood proposition is in front of the child. And I also believe, by the way, most children, unless they have a great-grandfather who instills in them atheism, the most children instinctively say, oh, yeah, and I'm going to answer to him one day, too. Now, maybe I'm wrong. most people I know will even confess that as a child, you know, that seemed to make sense. And they were worried that after death they would have to answer, so forth. But whether they confess it or not is not a test of the thesis. Well, he's just repeating himself when he says the dispositional analysis leaves unexplained why they are atheists. And I've criticized him yesterday in another setting. I want to remind you. Well, the interesting thing is, not only does Hodge give us an explanation, he didn't read Hodge, we know that, but somebody he did read gave the explanation. Look again at page 269, this interesting quotation from Alvin Plantinga trying to represent John Calvin's view. Plantinga says, were it not for the existence of sin in the world, human beings would believe in God to the same degree and with the same natural spontaneity that we believe in the existence of other persons, an external world, or the past. I agree with that. We come into this world, and as we learn to use language, it's just as spontaneous to say God exists as to say there's a world. My point is, Martin quotes that, and then at another point in his book, he says, there's no explanation for why there are atheists on this innate view. I don't think he's playing fair with us. And I don't know whether it's malicious. I wouldn't want to charge him with that automatically. But if it's not malicious, even he himself ought to be somewhat taken back when he realizes, oh, I said there's no explanation for this, and yet I quoted the explanation for it. What would make me screen out the significance of what I've quoted? Now, we have an explanation for that. I guess the only other thing we need to point out here is if you go down to the next paragraph, he says the second problem with this argument is that even if one accepts the factual premise, it is not that it's a factual premise that the knowledge of God is innate. It's not clear that the best way to account for the facts is to postulate that God has made humans in this way. And you'll be fascinated now what he gives as an alternative. He says, one could argue that a much simpler explanation of the facts is to maintain that belief in God has survival value for humans. Thus, the disposition to believe in God can be accounted for in terms of evolutionary theory. There are two claims here that he sets forth and doesn't argue for. In fact, he just throws them out there and then goes away. And both of the claims are outrageous ones, aren't they? Let's look, well, what is really the second part of it. He says you could account for an innate knowledge of God on the biological theory of survival value. Well, as I last looked, the theory of evolution maintains that what has survival value must be biologically inherited. I'm not getting into high-level stuff here. Y'all know that's just the nature of the theory. Because if it's not inherited biologically, any generation that has a mutation that is, you know, helpful for survival only helps that generation. So there's no evolutionary progress possible. Y'all with me? On his theory, therefore, he's saying that the disposition to believe in God, innate knowledge of God, is biologically passed down from generation to generation. Well, one, I know that he doesn't believe that. You don't pass down beliefs biologically, or even a disposition to believe. What would it be to have a biological disposition to believe in God that you could genetically pass on to your children? I mean, the whole thing is utter nonsense. I'm not saying that I've got evidence against it. I'm saying I don't need evidence against it. He's contradicting himself. Belief dispositions are not passed on in that way. Unless, now we're going to take this a step further, unless you believe that beliefs are formed and dispositions are formed in the brain tissue adventitiously. There are people, Dr. Barnes included, who believe that when we, with our minds, come to a conviction about something, that that does give us a disposition to behave in a certain way. However, I don't believe it's a biological disposition. I don't think it's a disposition in the brain tissue. But I also don't know what the connection is between brain tissue and mind events. And so all I'm saying is I'm not committed to that. But I know what it is to talk about a mental disposition and how it functions. Are we supposed to believe that Michael Martin thinks that there is a brain tissue disposition that is biologically inherited? This is wild. And then, here's the second part. This is why it gets me upset. He has the cheek to say a much simpler explanation of the facts. Well, I guarantee you that if you have some view such that you inherit from your parents a biological disposition in the gray tissue, and that gray matter is disposed such that you believe in God in such a way that it will have survival value, you're going to have one hairy thesis on your mind. Maybe it's right. It's certainly not simple. You see, I've got a simpler explanation. I can prove it's simpler because when my children were 5 years old, I explained this to them. And there's no way they could understand brain tissue dispositions that are biologically inherited. And so on both scores, I really am upset by this. This shows the desperate lengths to which this man will go. Of course, if the knowledge of God is innate, it doesn't have to be accounted for by God existing. It just could be the fortune of biology or evolution, that we have survival value if we believe in God. P.S., there's another problem. Elsewhere in his book, he argues that belief in God doesn't have survival value, that it's more beneficial not to believe in God. So what do we do with a man who plays games like this? Well, I don't know what you want to say about that. I can tell you what happens to us Christians when we play games like this. Because Christians do that, you know. I've seen, sadly, you know, brothers in the Lord in a setting where some professor is kneeling them and just twisting them in the wind, just back and forth. And what the Christian does is, you know, he runs to this, he runs to that, and so forth, and he's inconsistent, and he says things that he doesn't even genuinely believe, and so forth, because he's desperate. And you know how you get treated when you act like that? If you're a Christian, you're dismissed. You're not seriously considered. And all I'm saying is, hey, what sauce for the goose, the sauce for the gander. I don't seriously consider this from a scholarly standpoint. Anybody who will throw out something he doesn't even believe and can't make sense of and then claim that it's simpler than what I can explain to a five-year-old is not, you know, being straight up with me. I can take it when a person disagrees and wants to argue with my view, but he's not arguing. He's just playing games.
What if he takes the term evolutionary theory in terms of cultural evolution instead of biological evolution?
My guess is he doesn't think cultural evolution is meaningful. Because of his view of scientific explanation, I think he would say that everything that you call cultural evolution is only meaningful, factually meaningful, if you can specify conditions under which it could be falsified or confirmed, but you can't. In fact, when he talks about it in Chapter 2, he tells us that this does not apply to social science, because it's in the same way, not something you can decisively or even weakly confirm or infer. Okay. That's the most direct or most relevant aspect of the book for presuppositional apologetics, and it's really miserable. Let's look at some of the arguments that presuppositionalists might use and that he, in another setting, picks up on here to see if he does any better with them. On pages 35 to 38, he considers what might be the challenge of skepticism to objective knowledge. Pages 35 to 38. On these pages, it is Martin's hope to find a way around extreme skepticism. The most extreme case in the history of philosophy is often called the evil demon hypothesis that Descartes came up with. Whether there's an evil demon who systematically deceives us into thinking that when we've come to the truth, when we come to certain conclusions, we have the truth. And it's so systematic that we always make mistakes when we think we've got the truth and on and on and on. That in most cases, one is supposed to have good epistemic reason for, you know, what you affirm. That is, he does believe this is an ethical requirement. Now, in a minute, I'm going to go back and say, how can there be such an ethical requirement in your worldview? At best, you could make a prediction that if you don't hold to that view, you don't have survival value. But then some people are exceptions to that rule. Maybe they don't, you know, hold to that ethical perspective, and they survive very well. They cheat and get away with it, and don't tell the truth and get away with it, and all that. So he has other problems. But assuming right now that he's shown that you do need to have objective, rational grounds for things, somebody comes along and says, well, but you can't, though, because of the evil demon hypothesis. Here's this real strict form of skepticism. It may be objected that in our statement of what needs to be shown to establish that negative atheism is true, we're assuming something that we cannot assume, that adopting a presumption that only epistemic reason should be used, we are supposing that there is a close connection between having adequate epistemic reasons and truth. It's a desperate ploy on the part of the religious philosopher, but what you're going to see now, somebody says, well, no, you are wrong to press me for epistemic reasons, because, as a matter of fact, there's no necessary connection between epistemic reasons and the truth. People can have the truth and have nothing to do with epistemic reasons. People can have all sorts of epistemic reasons and be nowhere close to the truth. And therefore, basically, this is somebody who says, I don't need an apologetic. And this whole attempt to rest on rationality is misguided, because given the possibility of the evil demon, rationality is not reliable or trustworthy anyway. Y'all with me? He says, in particular, Jonathan Cavanagh has claimed that advocates of objectivist epistemology must assume that proposition P is more likely to be true if proposition E is true and is evidence for proposition P than if E were not true. Don't you love it when you get the long way of putting it? Basically, it's more likely to be true if it has evidence, okay, than otherwise. But this assumption is mistaken, Cavanagh argues, since it runs afoul of Cartesian evil demon considerations. In this possible world, there is no close relation between the evidence that people have for a proposition and the truth of the proposition, although it seems as if there is. And then he says at the very bottom of the page, what can we say about this argument? What can one say? First, if one takes the evil demon hypothesis seriously, then instead of claiming that belief in God can be rational, one would have to say that no belief at all is rational. Okay, so here's an effective answer for telling the religious skeptic, skepticism doesn't help you. And he's right. You know, if you as an apologist say, hey, I got this destructive weapon of skepticism, I'll just go out there and slay people, you need to realize they can turn around and say, yeah, and given what you said, you have no reason to think that God does exist either. He says it can only lead to the most profound skepticism concerning the rationality of all beliefs. Indeed, if the evil demon hypothesis were true, paradoxically, it would seem to entail that we could never be justified in thinking that it was. That is, we could never be justified by evidence. Because anytime you rest on evidence, you're going to be misled. So the only way to escape the evil demon is not to allow your mind to rest on evidence. Second, it is difficult to see how theists in particular could accept the view that there could be no connection between evidence and truth, for if God is all good, all powerful, and all knowing, why would he systematically deceive us into thinking that there is a connection? He says, surely this verges on incoherence. I'm willing to grant what he is saying because I do think that the God that I worship would not so construct the world that evidence doesn't have a probable connection with truth. My criticism here is, what gives him the right to speak for what God would be expected to do? Where did he get his idea of what God would be expected to do? The better way to put it, I think, would be for him to say, well, on the theistic assumption, this skepticism will not help you because now you've got a problem as to why God allows people to be misled systematically. Third, you're keeping score? The first two criticisms are only helpful in showing that you don't get a good apologetic out of skepticism. Third, even if belief in God is compatible with rejection of objective knowledge, the skeptical arguments that lead to this rejection are so controversial that it seems ill-advised for theists like Cavendish to attempt to support their position indirectly by accepting them. At the very least, a refutation of these criticisms of the skeptical arguments is needed. None is provided by Cavendish. I can't say this guy's name. Well, he says there are the skeptical arguments have been answered. A refutation of the skeptical arguments has been offered. Anybody see what they are? What a strange thing. This, in one sense, this man's life and death is at stake in this. Because he's got an opponent who is saying, you can't know anything. So you can't know that God doesn't exist either. And he's effectively said, well, of course, you can't know that God does exist. I mean, so he's turned the tables on him. But now at this point, what he's saying is, but that wouldn't be a very good idea for you to rest on these skeptical arguments because they've been refuted. And boy, they better have been refuted because, you see, it's one thing to turn skepticism around and say, you theists don't have an answer either. But the man who says that's in a sinking boat. All he's saying is, guess what? You're in the same boat with me. But by pointing out that there are a lot of people in the boat doesn't cease to sink. And so the first two answers are only effective in showing that we're all sinking. So now the question is, are we sinking? If he grants what Cavendish talks about, he hasn't, you know, survived. He's going to sink. So he has got to say that these arguments of the skeptics have an answer. This is the most crucial thing for him to do. And what bothers me is we get two sentences again, right? And the two sentences don't amount to giving us an answer. It's just a claim that the answer's there. Well, I've taught you enough from yesterday and today that you're beginning to see the pattern, right? Over and over and over again, when the going gets tough, Michael Martin goes shopping. Really? I mean, this is the point where he shouldn't just say there are refutations. He'd say, here are the refutations. I don't have to give in to skepticism. Because you see, what I'm going to do is I'm going to come behind this Cavendish fella, and I'm going to step into his shoes and say, I'm not a skeptic, but I can use these arguments of the skeptics to show that Michael Martin, given his worldview, has no place to stand. I can say, well, I've got a place to stand. I know you don't accept it and so forth, but given my worldview, I can know things. But given your worldview, you need to answer the skeptics. And since you haven't offered an answer, this is very effective. And many of you have noticed in presuppositional apologetics, this is what we do. It's called doing an internal critique of the unbeliever's position. You take your opponent and answer the fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. So you take him where he is and you reduce him to what? Absurdity. Or you could say reduce him to skepticism. You say, you know, on your worldview, you couldn't know anything. And so on your worldview, you couldn't know that my worldview is false. That's the unpacking, by the way, of one of Van Til's most famous little quips. He's got these great ones, illustrations. Van Til would go on and on, and he'd say, you know, given what the unbelievers are arguing, he's saying, nobody can know for sure, but we know that you're wrong. Well, if you're reduced to skepticism, you're just making a fool of yourself to turn around and say, no one knows anything, but we know that you guys are wrong. In that sense, the unbeliever who's reduced to skepticism, he has no defense. He has nothing he can say against us, you know? And so that's why I'm belaboring the point. Michael Martin needs to give us an answer to the skeptical arguments. But he doesn't. He just passes it off with an appeal to authority. We are supposed to believe on Michael Martin's philosophical authority, his competence, which we have challenged, by the way, and his objectivity, which we have challenged, by the way. We're supposed to believe on his say-so that skepticism can be answered. Well, I ain't buying it. I want more. And then he goes on, what possible reason could one have to consider seriously either the evil demon hypothesis or similar ones? Well, the reason why we shouldn't take it seriously, he says, is that there are simpler alternative hypotheses. He says, why, what possible reason could you have to consider it seriously? It cannot be to save theism from the charge of being irrational, for given the evil demon hypothesis, unless one radically alters the meaning of rational belief, no belief is justified. That's right. There is no more evidence supporting this hypothesis than the alternative one, that there is a close connection between evidence and truth. What is more, the alternative hypothesis, namely, that there is a close connection between evidence and truth, surely is much simpler than the evil demon hypothesis. I told you yesterday, when you see these words like surely, that's when you ought to stop and say, okay, well, I'm dull here. Since it's so sure, remind me. Why is it so sure that there is that close connection? Is any begging the question? In addition, the evil demon, oh, he says, therefore, on grounds of simplicity alone, the evil demon hypothesis should not be seriously considered. In addition, the evil demon hypothesis has a low initial probability. Given the possibility that an evil demon could have any of an infinite number of purposes and motives, it is unlikely that it would have and continue to have precisely those purposes and motives that would explain what we experience. Am I the only person here who feels like I'm getting bamboozled? What's your argument against the evil demon hypothesis? My argument is that's not a very simple hypothesis. I've got a better one. Well, could you show me the simplicity of your hypothesis? Well, my argument is it's not very probable that there's an evil demon. Based on what considerations? Given the evil demon hypothesis, every consideration you use to generate a probability is not true. And you can't generate a probability from all false propositions. So basically, you could only say that this is not probably true if you already knew that it was not true. And then he tells us it's unlikely that an evil demon could have such motives as would be necessary to sustain this project. What does he know about evil demons? Where did he do his statistical research, you know, so he could generate what is likely or unlikely about evil demons? I mean, I wouldn't want you to come to a class and just have a professor laugh at a person. I hope you can see in the analysis, but this is laughable stuff.
He does show that he has some contact with paranormal psychology, you know, at one point in the book.
Yeah.
And that's obviously not.
My point here is he's making claims that are just throwaway claims. Totally arbitrary. And I'm going to go back to my question. What if we were to act this way? What if he were to say, well, you know, I've got hypotheses that are more likely than yours in explaining how this world came into being and why we have moral motions and feelings and so forth. And then I would say, yeah, but your hypothesis is very complex. Mine is simpler. And not only that, yours is not very probably true. In fact, it's not very likely at all. Can't you just imagine him falling dead saying, oh, that's right. That's not very probably true. It's not very likely. I'm belaboring it because, again, I don't see why he gets away with it, why he thinks he's going to get away with it. Well, he's not getting away with it today. Last two lines of page 36. But then, if there were no connection between truth and evidence, our survival would be a mystery. I wrote in my margin, guess what? On the atheist view, our survival is a mystery. He doesn't even see how this is hurting him. He talks about there wouldn't be survival value. Now, let's say that I granted that. You can't account for how people could survive because they'd never be able to predict. And if you can't predict, you can't ever adjust to your environment. If you can't adjust to your environment, who knows what's going to come along that's deadly to you and so forth. So, it is true from a Christian perspective that because of our confidence in God's controlling the universe, that we can have dominion, to use the theological expression. That we can come to learn something about the universe, about the world, and that helps us have power, dominion, in God's world. That is, I have learned that if I plant wheat and harvest it in this way and prepare it in that way and bake it in this kind of thing, that I can have bread to eat, okay? But now, in a world where there are no connections, right, and where I couldn't count on any truth whatsoever, I'd never know whether planting the wheat is going to give me bread next spring or not. And so I wouldn't have any power or dominion in the world if there was no connection between evidence and truth. So I agree with him. But now you notice in my explanation of his thesis that I relied on what? Theological jargon, didn't I? I talked about God creating the world, about God controlling the world, God granting dominion in the world. Given all those things, it would be really strange to have God not allow any connection between evidence and truth, because then we couldn't have dominion. The weird thing is, there's no explanation of the survival value of that connection on the atheist worldview. He goes on to say on the top, page 37, that the evil demon hypothesis is not falsifiable, and so it's not a factual claim. Well, we'll get into his idea of falsifiability and factual meaningfulness when we get to chapter 2. And then he says, fifth, the alternative view has absurd implications. Consider the following subjectivist account of justified belief proposed by Cavick. The key here, just so I can cut through this and save time, is that the subjectivist account requires you to incorporate reference to when E, under these circumstances. He says, according to this view, there's a natural human tendency to believe on the basis of certain evidence that God exists, just as there's a natural tendency for people to make inductive inferences on the basis of past constant conjunctions. For example, there's a natural human tendency when contemplating the majesty of mountains, the starry heavens, or the beauty of a flower to respond with a belief in God. By the way, that's exactly what Alvin Plantinga says on page 269, but for some reason he's not referenced here. Further, the circumstances that prompt this response are normally accepted by persons with a belief in God as evidence for their belief, and they normally are without grounds for doubt, so forth and so on. Michael Martin says, now, one may well question whether there is a natural tendency to believe in God, or whether the tendency is based on cultural and social training. Okay, we've been there, we've done that one, okay. If there were such a natural tendency, one would expect belief in God to be statistically uniform in different cultures. Whoa! What's the basis of that expectation? Let me complicate my worldview a bit. I've already told you I think all people are born with a spontaneous disposition to believe in God when the evidence is there, and the evidence always is, so it's innate. I've already said as well that on my worldview, because of man's sin and rebellion, he is not disposed to confess that. He suppresses it and he won't say it. Now, what if I add to this, and on my worldview, most people, it's a generalization, most people have a measure of creativity. That's not so hard. Yeah. Now, given those three things, would I be surprised that there's a creative differentiation of ways in which people deny Jehovah? This is just not good reasoning. He says, if there were such a natural tendency, one would expect belief in God to be statistically uniform in different cultures. However, it varies widely across cultures. Well, we already know why it varies widely in terms of profession of belief, because sin is a complicating factor that he hasn't taken into account. But he goes into, as you know, saying, why is it that some cultures, you know, he sees the differential between, say, a Japanese culture and a Indian culture. Well, the answer to that is because generally in those cultures there are different concepts of God and the supernatural power. That's not surprising. So there's creativity in the ways in which people run away from God and formulate alternative hypotheses. And I can add to this, and it so happens that people who believe alike tend to congregate. I'm not talking just about church now, but that's true even in this nation, right? You find people feel more comfortable if you grow up in a Roman Catholic community, you're more comfortable as an Irishman going to a Roman Catholic community. Why is it that the Vietnamese who have come to this country have congregated over here in North Garden Grove, you know, in Little Saigon? Well, of course, some people think that's evil and all that. I'm not going to get into it. I think it's a very natural thing. So, given my views about creativity, the natural inclination of people to congregate with people with similar views and so forth, what he's citing here is no counterexample at all. Not at all. About the natural tendency to believe in God. He says, more important, if there is a natural tendency to believe in God, one can argue equally well that there's a natural tendency to believe in occult explanations. Equally well? Well, that all depends on what my argument is to show the universality of knowledge of God. He hasn't considered that, though, has he? Since he doesn't know what my explanation is, how can he compare it to an explanation about occult matters? He's acting like a magician is what I'm getting at here. You see, he wants you to forget that he hasn't done all this sort of stuff. You can't make a comparison to something you haven't looked at. So he says, equally well with the occult. But forget that for a minute. What if I say, okay, and there's a natural disposition for people to believe in occult explanations too. Is that damaging to my thesis? My thesis involves the complicating factor of sin. So if it should turn out statistically that people tend to move toward demonic explanations of things, you know, that might not be what I personally had thought, but that's not damaging to my thesis. My thesis accounts for that. That happens to be the adventitious way that the statistics fall out. He says, however, this is a reductio of Cavick's theory, since we have excellent reason to suppose that such occult explanations are not true. We've covered that. He does not tell us what the answers are to skepticism in general. He does not tell us what our excellent reasons are for dismissing the occult, nor has he shown anything in what he has claimed to be true about statistics that's inconsistent with the innate knowledge of God theory. Okay, at the end of the section on page 38, he says, other examples could be given in which, according to Kovenvik's account, people would be justified in believing in explanations in terms of ghosts and little green aliens, although strong objective evidence showed that fraud and deception prompted the beliefs. Surely this suggests that something is seriously wrong with Kovenvik's account of justification. Well, if there are such explanations, he says other examples could be given in which, according to that account, people would be justified in believing in ghost explanations, although the evidence showed fraud and deception prompted the beliefs. I don't think anybody could claim that that explanation would be as simple. Look at footnote 20. Is everyone there? I'm not going to bother to even try to read it. Do any of you think that that's a simple proposition?
Trivial.
I mean, that's amazing. It goes on and on and on with, you know, qualifications within qualifications and so forth. Remember, also, in terms of what's being sought here, is a belief in God that is without grounds for doubt at one point in discussion. When it gets that complicated, you don't think there's any grounds for doubt? I mean, I even have some minimal grounds to doubt that the typist got it right. It's so complicated. And not just in understanding it that's complicated, even stating it or typing it. And yet it's supposed to be something that a person believes without grounds for doubt. Ma'am, I'm not satisfied that on either score, when Michael Martin talks about innate knowledge of God, he's effectively refuted the idea or given any reason whatsoever to say that we shouldn't believe that. So to the extent that he's touched an aspect of presuppositional apologetics, he has not done it effectively or in any negative way. Now, we're going to take a lunch break. When we come back, I want to look at his argument concerning consciousness, C.S. Lewis's argument about naturalism, and then the argument about the objectivity of moral judgments. But these are three things that we use many times in transcendental presuppositional apologetics, and I want to see if he effectively deals with them. If he doesn't, I'm not sure. I've scoured the book. I could have missed it, but I'm not sure that he has anything else in the book that looks anything like presuppositional apologetics. And if I'm wrong at lunch, I'd appreciate you pointing it out so that I can, you know, cover everything. Because my conclusion is going to be, once we get through this, he hasn't even considered the best argument for God's existence, and to the degree that he's touched on aspects of it, he hasn't effectively countered it either. So that we really don't have a successful effort to justify atheism.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bahnsen, visit our website, bahnseninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.